From the home of the Codebreakers and the birthplace of modern computing, this is the Bletchley Park podcast. Welcome to this additional episode of the Bletchley Park podcast, Bletchley Park and Beyond. In the second episode this month, our oral history officer, Jonathan Byrne, shares two more interviews that really represent why the oral history project is so important to Bletchley Park. We're hearing in our oral history project at the moment from some very close neighbours to Bletchley Park, aren't we?
Yes. Judith Wayner actually grew up during the war in Wilton Avenue, the road that leads into Bletchley Park and used to be one of the main entrances to Bletchley Park. And she told us about how her parents had bought one of the houses in Wilton Avenue, brand new, in the 1930s. And, of course, as with so many local people, had staff billeted on them. Now, she does mention their names in the interview, but from what I can recall, they were quite sort of senior people, because I suppose if you're going to have senior people here, you've got to have them billeted as close as possible. So literally outside the gates would be a good place to do it. But of course, one thing she never did was she never went into Bletchley Park. Those gates were an obstacle that she certainly, until much more recently, she never went through. I'm very pleased to be interviewing Mrs. Judith Wayner, formerly Jarman, who is going to tell us about growing up near Bletchley Park in wartime. And also here, maybe to help from time to time, is Jean Cheshire, née Bud, who many of us will know. So Judith, can you just sort of start with your story from a very young age?
Right. My father was having the house built because there was land being sold from Hubert Faulkner. Yes. The mansion, yes. And the house was just finished, and they said we could either have it commandeered, I think that was what my father said, or we had to take somebody in. And we had a young girl called Elaine Parry, who came from Kensington, and she lived with her mum. Well, my parents used to go and visit her mum, and she was, I don't know if she was a widow or divorced or what, but Elaine came from the Foreign Office, and she had the small bedroom at the front, and we had to have my mother's cousin, I can't remember, from Dover, and they had the big front bedroom. So I had to sleep on a bed with my parents, and then they left, and we had a wing commander, Montagu Smith, from the RAF, and he stayed with us for a few years. But we had quite a few odd people come to stay, you know.
And this was in Wilton Avenue?
Yes.
And was what house that had been built just before the war?
Just before, it was finished 1939.
And one of the ones still there now, I guess.
Yeah, oh yes, very much so, yes. It's the first one in the road.
Okay. And you said you had relatives from Dover.
They'd
been evacuated, I guess.
Well, I think my mother took pity on them because they were bombed.
Yeah.
They were going to be bombed. And also then we had my mother's cousin from, they lived in Shepherd's Bush, and we had his wife, and she was German, so she had to go and report to the police station every week.
Wow, and she was living just down the road from Bletchley Park.
She was living from Bletchley. Yes, but I didn't know she was German until a long time after the war. My mother told me.
Well, that's interesting.
Yes, but I couldn't think why she went.
No.
And they lived in Shepherd's Bush, but that was quite dangerous at that time. Yeah.
Had you been born in Bletchley yourself?
Yes. I was born in the other end of Bletchley, Ferry Stratford.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. But when I was old enough to go to school, the Elmers, I think, was commandeered, wasn't it, at some stage?
Yes.
And so I went to school in the rectory. I can't remember how many of us there were, but there weren't that many.
Reverend Milne?
Yes.
Milne.
Yeah. Milne. Yes, that's right, when he lived there.
So that's the rectory for St Mary's Church?
Yes. Yeah. Well, it's been sold privately now, isn't it? It's a house. And then I went there for a long time, and then I went to school, obviously, after the war to Leighton Buzzard.
Yeah.
But I can remember living in Wilton Avenue. My father worked on the railway, and he was gone for hours, 12 hours stints at a time, and I remember he came home once quite excited by saying that There was a train going through. It was going to the brickyards. There were some of the treasures from London going through.
Yes.
They were going to be stored in the brickyards, you know, Stukely or somewhere.
Newton Road brickyards.
Yeah, that was Stukely, I think.
Oh, yeah.
We used to go through to Bedford.
Yes. Oh yes.
Not Stukely, Stewartby.
Stewartby, yes. Yeah. So on the line from here to Bedford.
Bedford, that's
yeah.
right. Yeah.
Oh, right, yeah.
And I can remember one night when the Blitz was on in London, you could see the light, you could see the flames from our back bedroom window.
Yeah. Oh.
Because people often say, you know, Bletchley wasn't bombed at all, but...
It was.
Well,
the lake was.
Yeah.
Do you remember?
I remember going to school one day from the back gate at Bletchley Park, going through the churchyard, and down by the war memorial, there used to be a little thatched cottage.
Cottage, that's right.
Yes. And as I went by, there was a great big hole, as I thought. I didn't realise it was a bomb crater. So I said to the gentleman, there was a little old man standing there, I said, "What's happened?" So he said, "Oh, a bomb dropped here."
That's right.
You know, so it was quite close.
Yes, it was. Well, they thought they were aiming for the railway, didn't they?
Either that or they were offloading on the way back somewhere. Yes.
Yeah.
I presume it would be the railway because
they thought,
it.
Well, I can remember. That's what I remember my dad saying.
Yes.
They were aiming for the railway.
Yes.
And were there other bomb raids that you remember around here?
Well, once or twice we had one of those big, well, they're called Morrison or Anderson shelters in the dining room, metal ones. Do you remember?
Yes, I think it was Morrison, yeah.
I can remember being put under there with my cousin. And another cousin, we had no end of cousins come to stay from Swindon as well, because we were put under there because there was the air raid went off.
Yeah.
We didn't have an Anderson, you know, we just under the table.
Just, well, yes, it was just one of these metal ones.
And did your father have to do anything like ARP or Home Guard?
Yes, ARP, yes, but because he was on the railway, he couldn't always do it, you know.
Because I suppose he was working sort of.
He was in the control office, yes, and you know, but 12 hours, you know, sometimes I didn't see him.
No.
To me, it didn't purpose, didn't see him for days.
And what were you aware of at the end of Wilton Avenue, this big place? What were your memories of what was?
Guards on the gate.
Yeah.
And also the gates were right down past the canteen now for the first house. And then Mrs. James, who lived
in the first one
at the other end,
yeah.
She had to move out.
Oh, did she?
Yes, she moved out and that was taken over. I don't know who.
Well, because that was within the gate now.
Well, it wasn't within the gate, but it was quite near.
Yes.
Because the fence came down here and her house was there. And then there was the path, back, what we used to call the back alley, to the railway.
So the gate, the main
gates were right.
Was further in.
Oh, yes. Three houses there.
Yes.
Yeah.
Because there was the Wrens there. The Wrens were stationed in that.
Yes.
You most probably know
that. Yes, that's right. Yeah. Did the traffic come in up and down your road?
Oh, yes.
So that must have been quite constant, I should think.
It was, I think. Yeah. Do you remember there was at all?
No, because we were
inside.
Well,
you were inside.
No.
Yes, it was quite constant. Yeah. Of course, when the Americans came, we thought it was wonderful.
Yes.
And then when Wilton Hall was, well, the Assembly Hall, wasn't it, in those days?
Yes.
Was built. Because we wondered what was going on there, but it was just a conference centre, I think. That was the idea, wasn't it, when it was built?
They did have performances there.
Yes, they had stage.
Oh, we had shows there, didn't we? And dances, because I can remember the Wing Commander. No, what was the one below? Squadron Leader.
Well,
that's right. Because he said to my mum, "How good are you at sewing?" So she said, "Why?" So he said, he was married and he lived in Welwyn Garden City. He said, "Well, because I've got my stripes." So she said to him, "Oh, right, okay." So I can remember her sewing these three bands, or one band, or whatever it was.
Yes.
On his.
Brilliant, yeah.
Yeah. But they were lovely. But we kept in touch with them for ages.
And this was Montague...
Smith.
Montague Smith, yeah, I think I know that name.
Edward.
Yes.
Teddy, he was called, and they came from Welwyn Garden City.
Yeah. I know what you're going to tell me, but presumably you had no idea what these people were doing.
No, I didn't. Certainly didn't. I expect Mum and Dad knew, obviously. Mm. No, I was too young to realise. Well, I mean, as I say, this Aunt Mattie, I didn't know she was German until Mum told me a long time after the war, you know.
So how did you come to know Jean then?
Because we used to play together.
Yeah.
With her twin sister.
Of course.
I will give you an instance when Judith, we used to call her, had a birthday party, and Faye and I were invited to this birthday party. And Mother said, "Well, I'm sorry, but you cannot go." unless Neville comes with you. So Neville had to come as well.
That's why I must get the photographs out.
Oh, please.
That little tiny boy at the end.
Yes,
Do you remember Mrs. Buck that lived at the end of the road?
No.
She had her great-granddaughter, I suppose, staying with her. And we all went down in a line, you know, me being the tallest, and then you and Faye and however many were.
Yeah. Below us, yes. I can't remember what birthday that was.
I wouldn't remember.
No. If he could toddle along and walk along with us.
He must have been three or four.
Yes, because he was only a baby when we first moved there.
And also there was another couple that lived down Church Green Road. Do you remember? Oh. He was in the RAF called Myers. He was French. Now, why? What they were doing?
And they were at Bletchley Park.
Yes, he was in. He worked in Bletchley Park. Myers.
Yeah.
MYA. Then I think in latter years he worked for the Telegraph because Mum saw his death.
Oh.
As she always looked up things in the paper. Yeah.
That's I remember a family.
There was Robert and Anne Myers. They were called the children. I don't know what the parents.
No, what were these other these people? There was a thatched cottage along. Because Dad remembers them after the war when we went down to Simpson, you know, they came there. Yes. During that time, this is leaping on till 1950, then Dad had the pub at Simpson. And we had this man come in and we had a young girl lodging with us and he came in to visit the pub, went home, and went to meet Dad the next day, probably at Hanslope Park, and he said, "Your girls, they let me know that I was in your pub." No, my girls wouldn't do that. Well, we didn't, because we was always told not to talk.
Not to say anything, that's right.
And it was this young girl that had blabbed, you know. But we would never say anything to anyone.
No.
When I think about it, all the people that we had staying with us, how my mother coped for food and washing and... I don't know.
No.
I suppose the Bletchley Park people billeted with you. She had to give them a supplement.
Oh, yes, yes. Yeah. I don't know how... I mean, I've no idea how much she was paid, but I can remember her going to see my grandmother who lived in Marston Mortain, which is near Bedford, and she used to bring home rabbits and...
Yes.
I mean, dead, obviously.
Yes.
Yes.
And eggs.
Yes. We used to keep chickens and rabbits in the back garden at the park.
Well, in our deeds, because we were laughing about this the other day when the houses were built, no livestock to be kept on. Anyway, we didn't anyway.
And did you ever go into Bletchley Park at
Not
all?
During that time, no. I did after.
Yes.
When my children were small, I used to go up there and go by the lake and feed the ducks. But then there was always a guard on duty, wasn't there? Lee, I think, was called something Lee.
So you only saw Jean outside, obviously.
Yes.
You weren't allowed friends in.
Until latter years.
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
I don't think you were you? Weren't allowed?
No, we weren't allowed. No. Once we got home from school, we was there.
You were there, weren't you? Yeah, that's right.
Yes.
But we had all the RAF camp, you obviously know that, where all the houses were there.
Yes. And that was put up sort of about 1943, is that right?
Yes, it was later.
Later, wasn't it?
Yes, because I used to play, this was when we first got there, with a Mary Phillips.
That's right.
Do you remember
Mary
Phillips?
Yes, she died sadly.
Yes, yes, she has. And we used to play in the greenhouse there because it was the walled garden.
It was beautiful, wasn't it?
Yes, it was lovely. And we used to play in this walled garden. When we had a reunion a few years ago, a lady was talking to me in the mansion in the hallway, and she said, I used to work here, you know. I said, "Oh, did you?" She says, "Yes, I used to live over there." I says, "What, in the walled garden?" So she says, "Yes."
Dauphin House.
Yeah, I didn't know what it was called.
Claudia.
Yes. And she said, I said, "Oh, Mary Phillips." So she said, "No, I'm her sister."
Who was that, Elsie or Doris?
Doris. Yes, because I got a photograph of her in here.
Yeah, I think she was the first person we interviewed. She went to work in Bletchley Park, didn't she?
Yes.
Doris, yeah. Because we used to keep all our pigs for her dad, Ernie Phillips. She used to come round and collect all the pigs.
They lived in the house just the other side of the mansion, or the other side of the... behind the cottages.
Yes.
Is that right? Which is, but I know it's not... You have to go all the way around to get in there.
Yes, so that was a big house. And Mr. Phillips kept... pigs. He had about half a dozen pigsties in that yard.
I remember collecting acorns. They used to eat acorns.
Oh, that's right, yes. You see all the things that come back to you collecting?
Well, funnily enough, I mean, this is slightly off track, so whoever's writing this up, you don't need to write all this down, but Doris, a few years ago, till she passed away, she lived in Olney. And she was the very first person we interviewed, not because she was a local lady, but because she'd been at Bletchley Park. And her daughter in Canada put me in touch with her, although she had another daughter closer to home. And we went there. I said she was the very first interview we did of Bletchley Park people. And it was all about her father, you know, who had, he had quite a large sort of business of growing...
That's right, because all Polish prisoners of war would they have been working there? Do you remember those, Jean?
Well, we've been prisoners of war for
yes.
Well, what they were a lot of Polish because my mum used to say, well, you know, be I, careful.
When I lived down in Newton Road, what's Mary Phillips' sister?
Oh, that one, Doris. Gosh, yes.
Oh, I did think I did put a name there.
Daisy Barley.
Daisy
Bailey.
Bailey.
Right.
Is that the one?
There was Elsie. Wait a minute. There was Elsie as well.
I shall look it up.
So we've talked in previous episodes how much insight the Oral History Project gives us into Bletchley Park and the life and the work here. I think that's particularly poignant when it's a history from somebody who is no longer with us.
Yes, sadly, Jimmy Thirsk died earlier this year at the age of 104. And I interviewed him a few years ago, I think just before his 100th birthday. And the wealth of information about him, about his wartime service, about, you know, his recruitment, all the sorts of things that we hear in these interviews was marvellous. But what he was particularly good at was the level of detail about the job that they did. And that is the thing that is so difficult to pin down in many cases, because so many of the records about what people did from day to day were destroyed so many years ago. And he worked in the military section. He was an army warrant officer in the intelligence corps. And he worked in what we know as traffic analysis, which was looking at not the text of the message, but where it came from, where it went to, and helping to build up a picture of the enemy's organisations, of their movements, which is as important as the actual text of the message.
Before the war, I was a librarian in public libraries. I'd started off at East Riding of Yorkshire County Library headquarters at Beverley. I did a couple of years there and then took some of the examination to the Library Association and managed to pick up a job in Lancashire in charge of a branch library of Lancashire County Libraries, which is a very large system. This was at Great Harwood, a town of similar size to Beverley, where I'd come from, but vastly different type of town, because it was a cotton town. And when I got there in 1935, there were only four mills running out of what had been about 24, a town of great unemployment. So I was lucky to have a job at that period.
So the war broke out and presumably you were called up, were you?
Yes, I was called up in 1940, September the 12th, a day not to be forgotten. And when I had the medical before, and they asked me what branch of the service I wanted to go in, and I said Army, Royal Artillery, only because a friend of mine was in the Royal Artillery, and I didn't want to go in the Navy or the Air Force. But when the papers came to call me up, I was just called to an infantry regiment for infantry training in the King's Own Royal Regiment, which is a Lancaster base thing, and I was working there. And most of the men called up that time were from Lancashire. And the infantry training place we went to was on the outskirts of Birmingham in a district called King's Standing on the Sutton Coalfield side of Birmingham. There we formed a recruit company of eight platoons of 30 men each, about 240 men. And we did our rigorous 3 months infantry training, which in peacetime would probably take about 2 years. But that time, 1940, September, after Dunkirk, of course, and there were all kinds of survivors from Dunkirk who were instructors there. A lot of the sergeants of in charge of each platoon had seen service in India in their time, regular soldiers. And that went on for 3 months. And then I went on a weekend leave with permission. And when I came back, the whole company had dispersed except for a few men who had been on leave, about 20 of us. And we didn't know what we were doing. And then they suddenly told us we were being transferred to the Royal Artillery Maritime Division, and were sent to Hull, which was my birthplace, actually, for training in naval gunnery, because merchant shipping at the beginning of the war were all merchant ships of any size, had guns mounted on them, sometimes simple machine guns, and sometimes the larger vessels, heavier guns, for mostly dealing with low-flying aircraft. We were trained in naval gunnery, which ended with firing a large gun out to sea off the East Yorkshire coast, trained by naval officers, most of whom had been retired and come back. This is a long story, I can't try and cut it short, but I did some service in Liverpool, working on ships while they were turning round in port, unloading and loading up and off they go, usually about 3 weeks, and the guns had to be manned in port nevertheless. And then one day I was called to the battery office in the town, Liverpool, and someone there knew I was a librarian and had suggested my name to look after some sort of card index of records of all the personnel, a couple of thousand people at sea all over the world. And my job was to sort these out, and every day we had notification from the Admiralty, a ship arriving, for example, in Melbourne, and the Navy would report back what the personnel on board. We would record that the ship with these two gunners, or six gunners sometimes, a larger ship, had arrived in Melbourne. So we knew exactly where every man was. Well, one day I happened to see an Army Council instruction, printed thing that came from the War Office twice a week, I think. I was reading through this, usually for amusement, and I suddenly saw a notice saying, men with suitable qualifications required for transfer to the Intelligence Corps. No further details. And I thought, well, this sounded interesting, and being a bit of a romantic, I imagined myself involved in some clandestine cloak and dagger business, and so I got permission to apply for the job, and I spoke to the adjutant, and he said, well, I'll arrange an interview with the major. So the major questioned me a lot about my peacetime job as a librarian, and said, well, after that, he said, I'll support your application. So off it went to the War Office, and after a time I had an interview in London, which not in front of a board, it was just one captain in the Intelligence Corps, who rather dismayed me by telling how they were recruiting mainly for the field security people, and did I ride a motorbike, and could I fire a revolver, and this sort of thing. And then finally he said, well, you haven't really got the physique for the sort of people we want, because they have to go about interrogating German prisoners and testing our own security, and it's a pretty tough life. So he said, but there's another job might be suitable. I can't tell you anything about it, but return to your unit and they'll probably let you know. Another interview came a few weeks later in London. This was before about 10 red-tabbed staff officers. And about 10 of us were interviewed, one after another. There was one civilian and I think an ATS girl, and the rest were soldiers. I was the last to go, being late in the alphabet, and so I was sitting there for about 3 hours waiting to be interviewed. And then the usual questions, did I do crosswords, did I play chess, did I do this and that, what was my job? So I told them all about the library and what I'd been doing in the maritime regiment. They asked a few questions like that, and then they said, well, we'll notify your commanding officer, return to your unit now. So I returned, and nothing happened for several weeks, and I thought, well, I had a couple of trips to London paid for, and that was that. And then one day the adjutant came towards me waving a telegram in his hand, and he said, better start packing, Thirsk. You've got the job. So off I went to London, expecting to be working there. The place I'd been interviewed at by the board of officers was in Piccadilly. It was a motor showroom, And he went in a side door, and it was above there. And I thought when I arrived there that this was the cleverly disguised headquarters of British intelligence. But no, it was just an office there. And when I called there with all my kit, a corporal said to me, "Oh, you've got to go to Bow Manor in Leicestershire. You can't get tonight. You'll have to stay in the transit camp. Here's a chip for the transit camp. Here's your warrant for the rail fare. Tomorrow morning, get the..." He knew the train time and everything. "Get the train. You'll be met at a village station." I've forgotten the name of it now. Sure enough, when I got there the following morning, there was a jeep outside with an ATS driver. She drove me a couple of miles to Bow Manor, which was a modern Elizabethan house. But at the site of the Bow Manor is where the Sidney family lived, actually. This was a Victorian replacement for the original house, I think. Unknown to me, and the whole month I was there, that this was also an intercept station. And in the vast grounds of Bow Manor were all kinds of huts disguised as cottages and things like that. And we didn't even see the aerials because we never explored the grounds. There wasn't time for that. I was only there a month, and we worked, and then we had to walk down to the village to where we were staying in a disused pub there, which has just got beds in, and we slept there. We had our meals at Bow Manor. And so I was only there a month, and only learned much later that it was an intercept station. But at Bow Manor, it wasn't a training ground, and when I arrived there, a young lieutenant, Lieutenant Bax, greeted me, and his first question, "Do you know the difference between a code and a cipher?" And I was able to answer that to his satisfaction. It wasn't relevant to the job anyway, because it turned out the job was traffic analysis. And he said, "Then I'm afraid we can't give you any instruction. You will have to go in at the deep end, and I'll put you along with Corporal Newt." And already Corporal Newt had a young private soldier with him, Eric Plant, who became a great friend of mine. So we worked with him for a few weeks until we learned how to do the job. After a month, we learned that we were going to Bletchley, a place I'd never heard of. They had an advance party of about four men, including my friend who'd been working with Corporal Newt. He went in the advance party, and I don't know what they were doing, but when we arrived with lorries and all the equipment and furniture and so on, Eric and his friends greeted us at the gate, and Eric, being a lover of food, rubbed his hands with glee and said, "The canteen here is marvellous," which was glad to know that, because army food was not all that good. So unloaded the furniture into one of the huts. I can't tell you which number hut it was, because we didn't really talk about hut numbers.
You only knew the one hut. The other ones, I suppose, were irrelevant, what their numbers were.
We knew which hut we were working in, but I didn't know it was hut 6 or hut 3. Anyway, there were about half a dozen or more huts, and more later on. And of course, then we moved into the blocks later on. It was okay in the summer, very, very hot. You could open the windows, but in the winter, with the stoves going and having to close the windows and the blackout, it was very stuffy and smoky. That's another point. Everyone smoked in those days, and nobody worried about it. Everybody smoked. Well, practically.
Can you tell me a bit about the actual work you did as a log reader?
Yes, well, the intercept operators at the Bow Manor and other stations, they wrote down the encrypted German Enigma and other messages on their pads, and they also had a separate pad for recording everything that came over the air, apart from the actual messages. The messages went to Hut 6 to be decrypted. When they were decrypted, then they were passed to Hut 3. But the other log, recorded by the intercept operators, they put down everything they heard over the air in Morse code, and occasionally in clear German. Just occasionally you'd get a bit of clear German where perhaps the operator was going to the loo and say, ear pissen or something. So everything that came over the air in the way of traffic, apart from the messages, was examined. So each day, and you were given a certain frequency, In other words, a certain German unit, usually the Air Force, they were perhaps headquarters in France. They had outlying stations of that unit, maybe three outlying stations or four. And each day you plotted by putting a central point and then spokes leading out to the outlying stations. You recorded the number of messages that went and how much traffic there was generally moving to different outstations. And by going to the direction-finding department in a separate room at Bletchley, if you told them what frequency your German unit was working on, they could tell you within a short time roughly where they were located, in France or Belgium or Holland or wherever, you see. They did this by ringing up north of Scotland and Cornwall and then drawing a line and it was verge on the place where the sound was coming from. Very clever business, this. And yes, it wouldn't give it the exact place, but within a mile or two it were.
Were these places static? Were they mobile or both?
The German unit might be there for some time and then they would move and you would get a new location. But at the time, at Bow Manor, and for about 6 months after we arrived in Bletchley, we log readers, about 50 of us altogether, were attached to Hut 6. We were not told that Enigma was being broken. And the fusion room, which was the senior people in our unit who had this knowledge, used to come in to see us. We were never allowed into their room. But Gordon Welshman was in charge of Hut 6. He was strongly advocating that the log readers, as we were known, we were really traffic analysts, but we talked about ourselves as log readers. He was strongly of the opinion that we should be told about Enigma because it would help to put the whole story together. So one day he gathered us all together into one room and told us the whole story about Enigma. And of course it gave us an added interest in the job we were doing. And then we got the people who were analysing the actual traffic, the messages, would come and consult us about certain units and what activity was there on this unit and so on. So it all worked together. Yeah. There were changes of names at the time. We became known as SIXTA, S-I-X-T-A, that's Hut 6 Traffic Analysis. So part of Hut 6. Another part was the fusion room. And this was where our material from the logs was fused with the actual messages to produce results. And in the fusion room, they had a big wall map, which was altered constantly, giving new information about location of German units. This vast map on the wall showing location of German units. And whenever they moved, they would alter the positions and so on. Of course, Welshman claimed in his book, the Hut 6 story, that we had a better knowledge of the disposition or a better knowledge of the communication system of the Germans than they had themselves.
Can you remember when the term SIXTA came into use?
I rather think it was towards the end of the war. Yes. I would think 1945.
Okay, that late. What sort of name did you have before?
Well, when I went to Bow Manor, we were known as the Central Party. They started off in London, and then because of the bombing, they wanted to move out of London.
Yeah.
And they moved to some intermediate place.
Were they ever at Hampstead?
Maybe, I don't know. Yeah. They lodged at Bow Manor, and they'd been there some time at Bow Manor. And during that time, one small group of them had actually solved the German call system. Actually, by the time I arrived, we'd been given a captured bird book, as they called it, which gave all the changes in call sign. At midnight every night, the Germans changed their call sign. So station GHP became station XYZ at midnight. So each day you had to work out who was the day before now, so you could work out the same unit. And we had the valuable use of the bird book. You just looked it up, you knew how to look it up, and you knew your equivalents on the day before. But a group of them in the unit had already solved this thing and created, based on a year's messages previously, had made a bird book of their own. And then the Russians, I think, captured one, and it was passed over to us. And I think we captured one too.
Did you know what the units actually were, what regiments and battalions they were?
No.
Or you just knew them by call signs?
I think we did, after they knew about Enigma.
Yeah.
We did know some more about the units then, because they obviously, from the message themselves, connected with that particular unit, they knew what the unit was. But it was of no relevance to us, really. But we did have this information if we wanted it.
But you were really just concerned with the continuity of the call signs, I suppose.
Yeah, we dealt with the call signs. Yes.
We always ask people, given the terrific range of jobs that they did at Bletchley Park and elsewhere, about equipment. Now, your equipment was presumably just pencil and paper, was it?
Yeah. Yeah, well, we had pro forma sheets of paper printed out with a heading, and we drew our little unit in the middle with the spokes going out, and we had coloured pencils to indicate different types of messages and so on. And then at the end of each week, we had to do a weekly report. Well, I mean, we weren't dealing with just one unit. I might be dealing with half a dozen different units. And if I'd been on leave for a couple of days' leave or a week's leave occasionally, I'd come back and find my pigeonhole was full of these logs and no one had dealt with it while I was away. But it hadn't the same urgency as messages. And you know, just get massive paper like this in the red. Oh, God, you know. I had to go all through this and sort it out in this way. You know, so half a dozen different units you were dealing with. You sort them out by frequency and then get to work and plough through them. So it was a bit tedious at times, livened up by good fellowship and amusement and smoking and joking. And,
Did you know where your output was going? You know, who was being told the results?
Yeah, well, it was going to the fusion room, yes. And our weekly report had to be handed in at the end of that week. And the person in the fusion room who was dealing with these matters would be working out from messages received intelligence matters. You know, perhaps that Unit A was from the message they were going to move next week to a different location in France or Belgium or wherever. So they plot this all on their war map again. So, but we didn't actually... they would come and discuss it with us occasionally, the people who were reading the messages, and ask for information, had I got this right, and watch out for so-and-so.
But did you know where the fusion room was then sending it? Were they sending a report to the War Office or...?
That I don't know, no. I don't think it would be direct to the War Office. I think it would probably be to some of the big boys in Hut 6 at the top, people like Gordon Welshman. Because soon after that, he got another job, though. He was over in charge of something else. But whoever was in charge there. There were people like F.L. Lucas, you know, the professor who had been in intelligence in the First World War. And he gave us a pep talk once, Lucas, and a very interesting man. He was very dynamic and full of knowledge about everything and a very inspirational sort of man. Yeah. And there were people like Calvo Caressi and others who they were in communication with headquarters in London at the War Office or the naval people at the Admiralty. There must have been quite a bit of cross purposes at times with different commands, because the Admiralty probably was always jealous of its reputation, because in the First World War the Room 40 OB was the equivalent of Bletchley in the First World War.
What was your working hours? Were you on shift?
Yes, not regularly, day, evening and night, but more at the beginning. I did quite a few nights and lots of evenings and lots of day shifts. But later on in the war, nights occasionally, but there was always someone on nights. But I remember one occasion I was on nights on my own and had the whole of the hut to myself. And Mrs. Whitmore, who was a civilian there, who was in charge of our section at that time, and she said, you're on your own at nights, aren't you? Would you like some company? So she put an ATS girl for company. So I can't remember who it was there.
Were there times where it was much busier, particularly around sort of the approach of D-Day or after D-Day?
Well, certainly before D-Day, or rather after D-Day, immediately after D-Day, we were given a pep talk by a chap in charge of the loggeries at the time, Blair Cunningham. Yeah, yes. Yeah. It was the morning after D-Day, and his voice was very throaty, and he said, "I apologise, I've been on the telephone all night talking."
Can you remember when you moved into the blocks?
First of all, we moved into an ordinary coloured hut when we arrived there from Bow Manor. And then after some time, we moved into the pink hut. And how long we were there, I don't exactly know. But then we moved into the block. Here we are. Yeah. So I'd arrived April the 6th, 1942, at Bow Manor. And then May the 3rd, 1942, Bow Manor to Bletchley Park. August the 20th, 1942, moved into Pink Hut. October 29th, we had a visit from General Nye, NYE. 1943, January the 23rd, Enigma was revealed to the log readers by Welshman. February the 15th, 1943, left the Pink Hut and moved to Block D. September the 18th, 1943, amalgamation of 4 and 6 schools. That would be when it became Sixter, I think. But I don't remember us calling ourselves Sixter. And then, of course, we were in civilian billets. January the 10th, 1944, we moved into Shenley Road Military Camp. And then October the 18th, 1945, I left Bletchley Park for Wentworth Woodhouse, which in Yorkshire, which was the headquarters of the intelligence corps. Because when you're redundant, you go back to your original unit.
So whereabouts have you billeted before you moved into the camp? Was it far away? Or?
Well, I started off very close to the park, 200 or 300 yards. And unfortunately, I was there about 6 months, I think, and I had all my meals in the cafeteria. All they got paid for was the bed for the night, pound a week or something like that. But I had all my meals with coupons in the breakfast included in the cafeteria because I could just walk there. But I fell out with this landlady because I was reading in bed late at night and a bedside lamp with a 40-watt bulb in, and she was complaining about me using too much electricity. Well, admittedly, she was paying for it, having to pay for it. But a 40-watt bulb doesn't consume all that much, even in those days. And then one night I was reading after midnight and she cut off the electricity at the mains. And so that was the end. And next morning I went to the billeting officer and said, "I want a new billet, but I wasn't going to stick for that." No. And unfortunately there weren't any billets close by. By that time they were moving out to the villages rapidly. And I moved to New Bradwell and came on the bus. Later on they gave us passes and we went on the train by walking into Wolverton Station and then a short ride down to Bletchley on the train.
The buses, they were run by Bletchley Park?
Yeah, they were all run by all kinds of buses they roped in. And because at night time they were restricted on the headlights. They had narrow slits, headlights, and the drivers, you know, had to get about wandering around villages all round about the place, 10 miles, 15 miles away from Bletchley. And I remember when you finished on an evening shift, you went out at 12 o'clock and they'd be departing at 12:15 and you'd go out there and it's pitch dark sometimes, perhaps no moon, and all these buses lined up and they'd be shouting out, you know, "New Bradwell, Wolverton." So you just found your way to the bus. And the others on the bus, you wouldn't know them, and they were civilians and Army, Air Force, all mixed up together. And when you arrived on a shift, morning or afternoon, 4 o'clock shift, or night shift to go on at 12, midnight, they looked at passes as you went in, but the chap at the gate would go on the bus with a torch and look at all the passes. You wouldn't have to file out and show your pass. They'd come and look at them on the bus and then wave the bus through and get off at the main house and go to your hut.
Can we talk a bit about the social side then?
I didn't take any part in things like there was an amateur dramatic society, there was a choral society, a music society, tennis. There was a small rifle range. I remember I used to go to there occasionally and try my hand. I took part in the formation of a film society club, and we organised a loan of films from the British Film Institute and showing documentaries and things like Night Mail, which was a famous film at the time. That was quite successful and good attendance. I only knew a smattering of German, but I started going to German classes organised by one of the people who are fluent in German. That was out of hours, of course, in the evening. And what else? Oh, a library, yes. There was a group of us there, not in my... Well, one was in my section, but I found there was a group of people who were librarians in civil life, like me. And we got together and we formed a library at Bletchley in the main building. We used to man it at lunchtimes. It wasn't open all the time. Anyone could join and borrow books, mostly fiction, of course. And we got some sources of books. At that time, there was a national appeal for people to give paperbacks and books in at any post office, and it was a sort of central fund for distribution to the forces. So we got some of those sent. And then later on in the army camp, when we moved into the army camp adjacent to Bletchley Park, we did the same, formed a library there. But a lot of my spare time, I would leave Bletchley and go to London, spend a night or two in London on days off. Accommodation was very cheap for soldiers in those days. You could get a cheap accommodation for the night at the YMCA or places like that. Or I used to go to Oxford or Cambridge in the other direction. In those days, there were a railway line from Bletchley to Cambridge and Oxford. And stay the night in Oxford and roam about the bookshops, go and see a play or a film, come back the next day. But I didn't play any musical instruments. A lot of people had formed groups, I think, and had musical evenings, and the plays, I saw one or two. And then they started showing in the big hall. There was a big hall outside the premises. The cafeteria was inside the perimeter, but outside the perimeter there was a big hall where they could show films. And they were showing captured Japanese fictional films and German films, things like that, which were well attended.
Did you manage to go home at all?
Well, on one long trip I got, so about 3 nights away, I hitchhiked up to Yorkshire and from Bletchley and stayed with my sister, who was a farmer's wife, and came back the same way, hitchhiking. It was very easy to hitchhike. I used to go to London sometimes, just walk up to Fenny Stratford and just hitchhike there down to London. Sometimes you could lift right down to London or perhaps to a tube station where you could hop off and get to the centre. Oh, we had some good times in London.
And, of course, you met your wife at Bletchley Park. She was working with you.
Yeah, well, she started at Bletchley in 1942 also, but not till the autumn. And she arrived there with two other ATS girls who became friends. She was in the fusion room using her German. She wasn't a graduate. She was halfway through her studies when she went in the army and completed her degree, but changed subjects after the war to history. But she had been reading German and French at Westfield College, London, who were evacuated to Oxford, actually. She was in Oxford for a year, and she'd taken part of the degree, and then single women were just as liable to call up. If she'd been married and had a child, she could have not been called up, but she had to go do some kind of national service and elected to go in the army. And these two other girls were also German scholars. One had taken a degree, Joyce, and the other one, Jean, who was a bit younger than Joan. She was started her studies. So they were all reading German, and their job was to read the German messages, actually, with a translation there as well, and analyse the contents of the message and make note of everything. And Joan claimed that it was marvellous experience for her future historical studies, because she always paid great attention to detail, like reading thoroughly and making notes on anything she was reading, so she could always refer back. And they had to note everything, you know, even the fact that some German sergeant major was having a wisdom tooth out and was absent for 3 days, had to be noted down, because he may turn up in another message somewhere else. I didn't meet Joan until 1945, towards the end of the war, because although I knew she was in the fusion room and I had seen her, we didn't become acquainted until the army camp was on. Then everyone in the army went into this camp, and she was a sergeant at the time, and I was a staff sergeant, I think, or sergeant, I may have been a sergeant major at the time. We were in the sergeant's mess, and the women were there too, and so there was a lot more fraternising or whatever at that time. And then Joan got a commission, and that meant that we couldn't be seen together in the camp. The Colonel Fillingham didn't approve that sort of liaison. People don't realise what absolute freedom there was in the park, because there was no saluting. And I mean, if you'd been saluting, you'd have been up and down all the time. And that film Enigma was all wrong in that. And it showed all people milling in and out of the house like that. And it was never like that. I mean, there were, I know there were 10,000 people there, or supposed to be. Yeah, I think that included the outlier stations, probably. And also, I mean, a large number of those would be on leave at any one point anyway, and doing night shifts as well. So there were never crowds of people like that you saw in the film. The canteen was always crowded. There were three shifts, and the, you know, had people having dinner at 2 a.m. in the night shift. You went over and had your roast beef and whatnot.
You said earlier on, when the war ended, you went to the Intelligence Corps headquarters. And did they find you another job, or did you just...
Well, you see, we were all given numbers for release from the army based on age and length of service. I was in Group 27, and the estimation was when we arrived in October at Wentworth Woodhouse, and there were people, field security people mainly, only a handful from Bletchley, field security people coming from all over the world. Some of them had, you know, been abroad for 3 or 4 years, and all being sorted out according to the group number. If I'd been group 24, they'd probably kept me there for a month, and then I would have been ready for discharge. But group 27, they estimated, would be another 5 or 6 months. So they sorted it all out, and eventually we were pushed over to Germany. And I was allocated a field security section there, which contains really about 10 men. I was stationed at Cleves, and our job was checking barge traffic on the Rhine. All traffic leaving Germany had to be checked, make sure they had the English zone passes, and that there was no one on board who wasn't supposed to be there. We didn't have time to search the barges, but there usually was a family on board with children and dogs, cats, even chickens sometimes on these big barges, living quarters, and the rest was full of coal. And then we just checked their passes, make sure they were all there, and that they had no one on board who wasn't accounted for. But we didn't find anybody. They found the odd one or two, I think, who were deported then and sent to special camps for deportees and so on. But it was a grim job, because it was in the winter, October to or November to March. It was quite cold on the Rhine there. And we had a house that was warm enough, one of the few standing houses in Cleves, that town that had been bombed by a 1,000 bomber raid before the Canadians went through it. So it's close to the Rhine. So that's where I ended my army days.
What were you doing at Bletchley Park from VE Day to October? Because that was quite a few months, wasn't it?
Well, we were really hanging about, not doing much at all. And some of them were writing up histories of the section, and I was doing some private study. But they wanted us to start reading logs, Russian and French. And a group of us, about 15 of us, said we weren't going to do this. It was a mutiny, really.
Yes.
And we were... I remember this officer, I can't remember who it was, a captain came in and addressed us all and about, you know, what's all this about? And we were just saying, well, it's terrible to be reading our allies, the Russians and the French. And here we are, the war's just ended, and we're reading their logs, and what for? And we just said, we weren't going to do it. So he just said, well, you know, you're redundant. So, well, that would have been fine if we could have gone home.
Did family and friends ever ask what you were doing?
Well, I used to get asked, and I always used to say, I'm with MI8, Communications. Because actually, when I arrived at Bull Manor, the central party was under MI8, Communications. But it meant nothing apart from Communications. But my canny brother-in-law, the farmer in Yorkshire, we were having a meal when I was up there staying on leave, and he said, he had his Yorkshire voice, he said, don't you get tired reading all those codes and ciphers? And I just said, I don't know what you're talking about, Arthur. I mean, I hadn't told him anything, he was just guessing.
Yeah. We go forward 30 years, and all of a sudden this big secret that you've kept for 30 years, someone writes a book about it. So what did you think about that? Well, Winterbottom in his book.
Yeah, well, the Winterbottom book came out, but and of course I was fascinated to read it, as everybody else was. But then I knew already that much of the information had been already appeared in public, and people just didn't notice it. I mean, even as far back as immediately after the war, when Time magazine reported on the Pearl Harbor.
You felt happy talking about your part in it once Winterbottom had spilt the beans, did you?
I didn't submit it to GCHQ or anything like that, and nor did the publisher. And I mean, after all, Welshman got into a bit of trouble with his book. But I thought, well, I mean, I'm not revealing anything that wasn't known already. So I just went ahead with it, and I never had any repercussions. I mentioned already that there was this great sense of freedom at Bletchley, particularly interesting for people who'd been in the real army. You know, all the ranks were mixed up together and, you know, you were doing the same sort of work, and there was no feeling of jealousy or this kind of thing. I found none of that. And we were a very happy group, the Logweed. I can't speak for other departments, but I made some very good friends there, and then when they moved to the camp, we were in huts with sleeping about maybe 20 in a hut, a bit long hut, and we weren't necessarily your own department. There were other departments, and no one talked about, you know, what are you doing? It was just assumed that everything was secret. I don't even remember signing the Official Secrets Act. These talks about people who said, produced a gun and said, if you reveal this, we'll shoot you or something. They just said, sign this. But you knew that you mustn't reveal to other people, and it was important.
Thanks to the paid and volunteer staff, visitors and veterans who took part in this podcast. To find out more, go to bletchleypark.org.uk. You can follow Bletchley Park on Twitter, Facebook and Instagram. This podcast is produced for the Bletchley Park Trust by MC Fontaine and supported by Audioboom. If you like this podcast, please leave us a review on iTunes. Thanks for listening, and we'll have more decrypts from the home of the Codebreakers next month.